Hello, and welcome everyone to the launch of Oncology Decoded: Cancer Science Meets Clarity. We're very pleased to have you all here and join us virtually as well as in person. The reason why we started this is too often groundbreaking research remains in journals, disconnected from the real-world practice. Our goal is to change that, to translate science into actionable, patient-centered solutions that truly make a difference. We focus on critical gaps in community oncology care and ensuring that no patient is really left behind. What sets us apart is to support our commitment to real-world clinical decision-making rather than simply presenting trial data. I really want to extend our sincere gratitude to Cancer Network for this opportunity, my co-host, Ben Garmazy, for his expertise, collaboration, all of our panel members that are joining us today to launch this first three episodes for Oncology Decoded. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention my wife, Maitri, for supporting me in launching this and developing this and making this a reality. So with that, we will dive into today's discussion.
Non-clear cell renal cell carcinoma. There goes the mic.
You're loud.
A topic that we don't always spend so much time on in these educational sessions, and we're going to introduce our one panelist for this, so please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Steph Berg. I work at the Dana-Farber. So if you guys don't know my boss, so I know a little bit about kidney cancer, so thank you for inviting me.
So that brings us into advancing the treatment landscape for non-clear cell renal cell carcinoma, practical strategies for multimodal care.
Yes.
So we have three of us here, and we've introduced ourselves with Dr. Berg joining us on the panel. So we're going to set up a case, and this is like a real patient, but you know, we're not really just going to only talk about this patient like we haven't in any of the other sessions, so why start now? So you have a 63-year-old female that presents with a 20-pound weight loss, a new cough, it's developed over 3 months, and you do a CT scan, and it shows a 9.7-centimeter renal mass and bilateral pulmonary metastases, and we're going to give a number that's clearly not oligometastatic, okay? So it's 6. And 2 bone mets.
Sure.
Labs are within normal limits, aside for some mildly elevated creatinine, and you biopsy it, and it's papillary renal cell carcinoma. Okay, so that brings us into level setting. What is non-clear cell carcinoma? And honestly, this slide doesn't do it justice because it doesn't include everything. It's way too short of a summary because it's not just papillary renal cell carcinoma. That's cheating. But you think about clear cell, that's 70-75% of patients. You think about papillary, that's 10-15% of patients. Chromophobe, 5-7%, and then we go further down the list with translocation and other subtypes. We don't need to squint to go all the way down there. And then you also have pure sarcomatoid renal cell carcinoma as well that we sometimes think of as on a spectrum of an aggressive clear cell biology, though they do behave a little bit differently. And then when we look at papillary, when we talk about variants, renal cell carcinoma, which is another fancy way of saying non-clear cell, most of the data is in papillary, and that's because it's 10-15% of the population, right? So most of the data is where the patients are. And you can see here, historically, we haven't been doing a great job of treating these patients with overall response rates that are not approaching or barely approaching 30% in some situations. Progression-free survivals that aren't getting us to a year, getting us to about a half a year as you summarize all of this. So we're not doing a great job historically. And then you look at PAPMET, which is a phase 2 trial, and one of these questions had the word MET in it. And the reason is because some papillary RCC has MET expression and is, we think, is somewhat driven by that expression. And this is a study that looks at 4 different drugs, cabozantinib, which is a multi-TKI kinase, and then 2 more MET-selective inhibitors, right, with crizotinib and savolitinib, and then, of course, a standard of care sunitinib, which is a dirty multi-TKI as far as the receptors it targets, which is the control arm in all of our clear cell as well as our non-clear cell studies. And what you can see here in this trial is cabozantinib overperforming the more pure selective drugs in this in papillary disease. And then we have now data with tivozanib, right, which is one of our newer VEGF TKIs, which is more VEGF selective than some of the other TKIs. When we think about what are the TKIs we use, we think of tivozanib and axitinib as more VEGF selective drugs, and lenvatinib and cabozantinib as more less selective drugs instead of saying more less selective, but you get the point. But there's data here with progression-free survival of 6.7 months, which is stacking up with some of the other less selective TKIs that we saw in that earlier slide. And you can see here, there's some data with disease control rate, which is kind of cheating because that means stability as well. But in chromophobe, collecting duct, papillary, and basically all non-clear cell at 73.7. So clearly some activity with a VEGF selective drug, which is going to confuse the conversation. And then we have some other phase 2 data sets that I think are highly important, right? So the combination of cabozantinib and the immunotherapy nivolumab, which is obviously a combination we use a lot in the frontline clear cell setting in metastatic disease, with data now in non-clear cell as well. This is a little bit older data set. But you can look here, they divided up the cohorts. And the reason we're going to go into the weeds here is because when you go into non-clear cell, you have to be in the weeds or you can't treat the patient in front of you. They have chromophobe in cohort 2 and the other patients in cohort 1. And you can see in cohort 1, the response rates are about 48%. So half of your patients are responding in non-clear cell disease, but zero responses in chromophobe disease. And you look at the waterfall plot, and that's what that shows, right? There might be some activity in chromophobe patients, but it's not getting us that 30% threshold that we call a response. About 1 in 2 patients responding with non-clear cell disease. And you can see it with cabozantinib and nivolumab across subtypes. You can see translocation there. You can see papillary there outside of chromophobe. Which brings us to the other data set, right? Phase 2 of lenvatinib, another multi-TKI that obviously has VEGF activity that we use in frontline clear cell, with pembrolizumab, a different immunotherapy. And you can see here a very high median progression-free survival of 17.9 months and an overall response rate that's about the same at 50%. Here, you see activity in chromophobe a little bit, 28%. It's modest, but it's not zero. And then we should mention very small numbers on that first study, less than 10 patients. But you can see here activity across the subtypes, chromophobe less than the others. The waterfall plot looks kind of the same, right? But patients are deriving benefit, even though these drugs were designed in a clear cell population. Which brings us to the newest data set, and this was presented in the fall at ESMO, the European Congress. And you can see now we're looking at nivolumab and ipilimumab, and we're scrapping the TKIs, and we're comparing it to a standard of care therapy, and I highlighted here, 87% of that was monotherapy TKI. Some of those did get IO-TKI combinations, but let's just pretend, for the sake of argument, arm B is monotherapy TKI, most of those patients getting sunitinib, some of those patients getting newer TKIs. And you can see here, finally, we're getting some activity where maybe ipi-nivo in some patients is outperforming monotherapy TKI. Response rates are about 33% on ipi-nivo, but it's outperforming the monotherapy TKI, and it's showing activity with a pure immunotherapy approach in a patient population. Now, the median PFS leaves some to be desired. It's at 5 months. But when we use immunotherapy, we don't always think about PFS, right? We're thinking about what is the tail of the curve? Can we get a durable remission out of the immunotherapy approach? And perhaps, and we're not going to go into this slide, but perhaps in chromophobe, maybe there's a signal here, because you look at the papillary RCC across the top, and you look at the non-papillary RCC across the bottom, and that blue line showing that perhaps some of those chromophobe patients are deriving more benefit from the combination of nivo-ipi versus a monotherapy TKI. And now, of course, we have ongoing studies because none of the data I presented was level 1 evidence. None of it was a phase 3 trial. We have STELLAR-304, which is looking at a new TKI from Exelixis called zanzalintinib plus nivolumab in a non-clear cell population, excluding chromophobe collecting duct because of the data that their phase 2 showed, also excluding renal medullary carcinoma, which we're not going to talk about today, but those patients actually use chemotherapy in those patients. PAPMET-2, looking at cabozantinib and the PD-L1 inhibitor atezolizumab, right, versus cabozantinib alone. That first one I should mention, the control arm is sunitinib. So PAPMET-2 is looking at patients with papillary disease. And then we have the SAMETA trial, which is another phase 3 study, looking at savolitinib, and this is in a patient, plus durvalumab, the immunotherapy. And it's randomizing against sunitinib as well as durvalumab monotherapy as well. So this is a more complex. And this is in a patient population that's not all papillary RCC. It's got to be MET-driven without co-occurring FH mutation. So it is a very biomarker-selected trial. So that's the landscape. And now we have the tough question, right? Dr. Berg, how do you treat non-clear cell carcinoma with a patient in front of you?
That was a whirlwind. I loved it. I think when you think about kidney cancer right now, it's almost the same thing, right? So we're saying there's the non-clear cell and clear cell, but we're actually treating everything the same. So, right, we're using the same regimens with the same drugs, except for HIF-2 inhibitors, which we know. Belzutifan, these tumors are not VHL driven, so we're not gonna use belzutifan in non-clear cell papillary. We're not gonna use it in chromophobe. That's not the genetics of it. So I think these trials show that we can do studies in this space. I think it's really going to come down to a person's preference of how they use the combinations. I think the Len Pembro has the most compelling data of IO, but it wasn't a randomized trial, it was phase two.
Right.
So I think enrolling on trials, if we have them open, we have a cooperative group study, we have a pharmaceutical-led study, if you have it available, is the best thing you can do, and also get the right pathology, because there's differences, as you noted, between chromophobe, we're seeing different signals, maybe between translocation, make sure they don't have a collecting duct, make sure it's not RMC. So I think that's the first step, but I tend to go more towards, right now, a combination if I can't put them on a trial.
And that combination is an IO-TKI combination.
IO-TKI combination. So that's what I'm leaning for. The SUNY forecast, really, a lot of us are stopping to think. I just want to point out in that there was still a high PD rate. So we always have to think about patients, and that was like over 30%, right? So if you're having a patient with papillary and they're in the visceral crisis, I think that's where you can bring in how a lot of us think about, even with clear cell, if you can't use that high PD rate, that 30% PD at first scan, then you're gonna go away from a CTLA-4 based regimen and really go in with a TKI to get that disease control. We know, at least for the clear data from clear cell and what Jolie did with Len Pembro, it works really quickly, so you can get really good control of their disease, but I think it's the subtype doesn't matter right now, because these trials, so they're all baskets, so we're trying to see if it matters, right? And Samita, we have that open at the Farber, but it's actually closed right now. They're going through a whole redesign, and it was extremely difficult to find that MET population, to get that tissue back, you know, and people can wait or not, so that was challenging for a large sponsored trial. And I think in PapMet, there isn't central pathology review now, and that's also struggling for accrual nationwide. So it's really tricky. So I think we want to say it matters, but right now these studies are showing it's maybe it really doesn't matter that much for what was included, right? Maybe chromophobe, but I think most of us are still going to want to treat chromophobe with a IO-TKI regimen or enroll in the study, because we got to love clinical trials here. So.
How often are you actually doing molecular testing for these patients?
I don't do normal somatic testing, but it really what my pathologist kind of tells me, if they say something like a translocation, they'll do the FISH and try to do that, but we don't necessarily get like MET or NGS. I don't necessarily do that. I don't think a lot of people do that even in clear cell kidney cancer. We don't really, I mean, we can find VHLs for clear cell, but germline I think would be important. I know, you know, Marie Carlo does a lot of that at Memorial to, if they're younger, there's a lot of guidelines for, you know, FH deficient and some of those HLRCC, which is important, but I don't know if it's really standard. I don't know if it really changes our management right now to do that.
So, you know, coming back to the pathology question a little bit,
sure.
When you see the pathology report that says clear cell with papillary or papillary with like this mixed picture, what do you think about those patients? How do you actually think about them? Do you think about them?
It happens way too often.
It does.
And like papillary features, and it's always tricky too, like where the tissue's coming from, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it coming from a metastatic site versus the primary tumor? And I know our pathologists always say, you know, you can't like do Furman grades, you know, if it was clear cell on a metastatic site, you can't say it's like Furman grade. It's sometimes tricky because of how much tissue you have. Maybe that would be something where if you have enough tissue to send for NGS, could you do a tumor-informed approach where some companies do let you know if there's certain mutations driving it, that this is leaning more towards that. But again, in the end, all the treatments right now are all the same. So I'm not sure it's really
relevant.
I think it's more academic, as we say. But I'm not sure it's going to matter in the end, because we want our patients to do the best they can, get the best response. So maybe in the future, if this whole MET-driven picture is real, because, you know, Tony did the first trial with Savoir, that closed, there wasn't enough accrual on it. Then he's, you know, he's leading the Sameda trial, but that's on a pause right now for accrual. So it's we haven't done it yet. So I hope we can, but right now it's all the same.
Yeah, and Manoj, what are you giving?
Yeah.
What am I giving? I'm usually probably giving, it's a little hard one, probably either Pemlen or Neocabo. But, you know, to flip that back on you, yeah. Right? So, and I'm going to ask you the same question, Steph, is you had, you know, I called you out on this previously, which was learn one and then use that, right?
Use that well, sure.
Right. Do you still stand by that? I mean, we're seeing some...
I dig into the weeds here, and that's why I actually bothered with the slides. And this is the one time where I think it matters. And I think in chromophobe disease,
Yeah.
We have two choices. I think probably if you're listening to this podcast and you don't see a lot of non-clear cell, I think lenvatinib pembrolizumab is what you should use, right? And I think we can give that guidance. If you want to get fancy and think about a young patient where maybe you give ipi-nivo because there might be a signal based on SUNY forecast, and then you can come back in and give lenvatinib everolimus because you haven't burned your lenvatinib card, I think that is a very reasonable sequence in chromophobe. But we also know that primary progressive disease is higher. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to just the safe approach, probably with a 28% response rate, if that's safe, would be pembrolizumab and lenvatinib. I think in the other tumor types, especially in papillary, while we do have a lot of data with pembrolizumab, I think that's very reasonable. We have more trials with cabozantinib in papillary as well. So I do think cabozantinib and nivolumab is a very good option in papillary RCC patients. And the way I make that decision is based on the dose of the TKI I think that patient can tolerate, because you would be giving cabo at 40,
right,
with that patient, versus the lenvatinib dose that showed that response rate is a more higher dose of that TKI, which is going to be harder to tolerate. And we know now that the dose matters in these TKIs.
Yeah.
So if you're going to reduce the dose, you have to wonder what that waterfall plot does as well when you're making those cross-trial comparisons, which we actually have to do when we treat the patients in front of us, right? So I think that those are all reasonable, chromophobe and papillary, translocation and everything else. I am leaning more in pembrolizumab and lenvatinib because just there seems to be more active across the subtypes. These are small trials. And what bothers me about this is that we don't have anything that's really going to answer any of the questions about what's best, because we're going to finally generate some level one evidence, and that's what we're going to use for everyone. But it is going to be a one-size-fits-all strategy, and that's the problem. These are different disease states, and we're all treating them like the same. And I think part of the reason that the accrual, as Dr. Berg is mentioning, is struggling in the U.S. is because we have these data sets with IO-TKI combinations that look way better than the TKI monotherapy. So it is hard to randomize these patients, even though scientifically we have to find a way to do it. We also have that impetus to treat the person in front of us in clinic with a combination therapy approach. So I think that's the other challenge. And I do, though, want to push, now that I've given my soliloquy here on stage about how I treat this, is I want Dr. Berg to look at this slide.
Oh, yeah.
With the failures of the MET inhibitors and tell me why we're going back down this selective approach.
I think also when Pedro published this in JCO and the OS was not positive, right? It was something where when Monty first presented it at ASCO 2021, I remember I was a discussant for it, cabo became this like new standard of care, right? For papillary, and it was a feat because this was a SWOG study done in the cooperative groups for all these investigators putting on rare tumors, randomizing them one-to-one for all this, and it was terminated early for that MET-driven, and it just wasn't, they couldn't find enough, and it was just like below accrual. So I don't think the MET story is dead per se, but it is struggling.
Yeah.
It is like trying to like creep out of the grave, because we have to try to do these biomarker-driven trials, and they're really, really difficult, and cabo has been, we don't know if cabo is actually the one that we should be using. So that's why with PapMet 2, I still encourage everyone to enroll in that, because that's actually using cabo 60 to 60. So that's actually quite nice, because you're actually getting full dose cabo with IO versus a dose reduced cabo. But again, it's how someone feels as your gestalt of, are you okay with getting randomized? How are we counseling our patients? Because we don't know right now if IOTKI is better, but we have wonderful phase 2 data, but it was phase 2, it wasn't randomized.
And you know, me and Manoj are new to this podcasting thing, and so for those of you that are listening to this on your drive home or your drive to work, whatever, we went back to the slide looking at the more MET selective inhibitors versus cabozantinib, where we have no signal that anything is better than anything else,
right?
But if anything, the cabozantinib arm is a little bit higher.
A little bit.
But small numbers, not high quality data set, but an interesting signal of no major difference.
Yeah, the curves are all jibble-jabble on there. You know, it's hard to interpret small numbers with the events. It's tough.
So what are you doing, Dr. Berg? Are you kind of following Ben's approach? What is your approach in approaching someone like this? And then what do you do when they don't respond? What do you go as next line therapy?
And you don't have a trial, right?
Because
this is a community patient, and they can't travel.
I think if we don't have a trial, I agree, the Len-Pem is looking. I mean, that's what we also see in clear cell. I mean, it's having the PFS rate, the response rate, that's kind of our, it seems, the most active regimen right now that we have in kidney cancer. So that's what I use as well. And I think a lot of us are really more comfortable with it now, and dose reductions and how we can support care of patients and how we can do that. And starting at the top, going down, as you mentioned, I think that's important. But I know there's other people that like to go, it's different dosing too, right, in endometrial cancer. So, going up low to high and high to low, I think more it's high to low versus going up. But I get how people wanted to start low, especially for blood pressure issues and things like that to try to see. But nobody knows if that's, we know it's kind of wrong in a sense of it's not inferior when the trials Monty did. But I always say start high, see them often, change the dose.
And Manoj, how are you monitoring blood pressure at home? Because that is the big toxicity that we worry about. How are you doing that for your patients?
Yeah, they're all required to keep a log, right? One to two times a day, depending on other medical issues or such, they keep a log, they bring it to us. We see them once a week. They see either me or my NP, and we adjust the medications
accordingly. And you put parameters for when they should call in so that you know to adjust?
Of course.
What's your parameter that you
use? Usually around one, greater than 160, I'll have them call us just to modify.
Yeah.
If the diastolic was over 100, I'll have them call. Especially in patients that have had other comorbidities, right? The last thing you want them to do is stroke. So that's the reason why. I have an additional question for you, Dr. Berg. When you have these patients that are presenting to you at time of new diagnosis, and they, this patient that Ben was talking about earlier did not meet the criteria for oligomet, right? So this evolving space in kidney cancer of radiation along with combination therapy, how do you see that fit in the non-clear cell space?
As my friends in radiation, I mean, radiation kills everything, right? It's energy. So I think it's something where in prostate cancer, we have such lovely data, looking at this, and we do it often. I think in kidney cancer, there are certain patients that are going to come in with low burdens of disease. And especially if you think of a chromophobe patient, usually it could be more indolent, but we know it's more aggressive. But we just don't know. But I don't think any of us would not offer radiation. I think you would see them, and if they have a bone met or a lung met or a resection, you're just going to do it. And I think it's completely okay, because it's maybe it'll save them some time off treatment. We have active therapies, but I think that's, again, I love the multi-D theme here with all, if we had some more seats for urologists and things, because I think we're all gonna do it. I think it's necessary. Obviously there's an amount and number of what we're doing, but they had their nephrectomy, and we don't have adjuvant therapy, by the way, for non-clear cell. We have no idea. We don't know yet. If I know there's some trials being discussed about how that would look like, but if they're gonna med out in a certain time, I think radiation surgery is great, and you could give them a lot of time off TKIs, which make patients feel pretty awful.
Similar question for the oligoprogressive disease, right? If you find one that's progressing and everything else is fine, I mean, do you often think about radiation to those?
Absolutely.
And then just have them stay on the same therapy, or?
Yes, I think it also depends where. I think that was a really important point of where it's going. And with our friends, like with the mRNA adaptive radiation, which is super cool if you have access to that in the community for a radiation oncologist for certain areas, it's really interesting in how they do it. But if you don't have access to it, it is something where that referral to a tertiary center to get that might be a really important thing, and they can see on their therapy. But remember, when they're getting radiation, usually they ask to hold their TKIs. Like, I think they ask us to hold them for maybe a week or so before and after because of the toxicities, but why not? I don't think that's a wrong answer, but I'll go progressive or during it. I think we do it depending on, again, the volume.
Sure.
I think it's the volume, but why not?
And I think with the last question, I think we know the answer to this, but you're progressing now on your IO TKI combination of choice. Are you just sequencing the same TKIs that you would sequence in like a clear cell type patient?
Yeah.
And do you have one that is your second line go-to or your third line go-to, or anything specific comes to mind?
I think right now probably tivozanib or sunitinib, if we can't, again, put them on a trial and that. But I think, again, it's very akin to clear cell because we haven't defined that. And that's okay for now. I think the community is working on it. But it's just getting it out there that we don't know exactly the best front line, but we have really nice options. And again, if you have a trial opportunity, that's wonderful. to kind of seek that out, because this is what this where it's really needed for these rare, you know, these rare cancers. It's not prostate cancer, it's not bladder cancer, so we don't have as many patients we can get a lot of this data from.
And you're singing the praises when you talk about trial opportunities when you're speaking to the Sarah Cannon representatives on here. You know, community oncologists, we like to enroll patients on trials too through Sarah Cannon
Absolutely.
Research Institute. So with that being said, I'd say thank you. We have a few more questions, but thanks for all of you listening at home or listening in your podcast feeds. I hope you got something out of that session. Of course, you may have walked out with more questions than answers, but that's okay.
That's okay.
It's hopefully was informative in some way.